This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, my name is Dean Hart, and I'll be reading to you some current articles from Newsweek magazine. This comes from the politics section of the magazine. Could anti-Trump Republicans form a brand new party? By Kate Plummer. Despite some moderate Republicans' dislike of Donald Trump, experts have told Newsweek that it is unlikely that they will form a new party in protest because of the trappings of the two-party system. Last week, Trump was named the GOP's presumptive 2024 presidential nominee after securing enough delegates across multiple primaries. Meanwhile, his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, was elected as co-chair of the Republican National Committee alongside Trump ally Michael Whatley, showing the MAGA movement has well and truly sunk its teeth into the Republican Party. Last week, Lara Trump told Real America's Voice that people who don't support Donald Trump are welcome to leave the party. MAGA's victory has not quelled anti-Trump dissent and infighting within the party, and a number of moderate Republicans and supporters of Nikki Haley, who ran against the former president in the primaries, have indicated they would never vote for Trump. This week, Trump faced more coordinated protest when the PAC Republican Voters Against Trump sent $50 million on 100 videos recorded by anti-Trump Republicans explaining why they no longer support him. Newsweek reached out to the Republican Voters Against Trump via email for comment. Meanwhile, Ken Buck, a Colorado congressman, suddenly resigned last Tuesday, leaving his seat vacant from next week and shrinking the Republican slim majority in the House to 218 over 213. Upon resigning, Buck teased that there may be more Republican resignations in the House of Representatives in the near future. Regardless, moderates will likely stop short of forming their own party in their battle against Trump, according to experts. Thomas Gift, who heads the Center on U.S. Politics at the University College London, said forming a new party would be political suicide. Trump has remade the GOP thoroughly in his own image, Gift told Newsweek. While some establishment Republicans would like to see the party break from their leader, it's still a small set who couldn't command anything remotely like a governing majority. American politics, by dint of its single-member districts and first-past-the-post voting, naturally gravitates toward two parties. For that reason, Republicans who wanted to form their own party would be on a political suicide mission. It wouldn't work. The only way is to reform from within, he said. A third party or independent candidate has never won a U.S. presidential election. But in October 2023, Gallup found that 63% of U.S. adults now agree that the Republican and Democratic parties do such a poor job of representing the people that a third major party is needed. In February, Trump's ex-chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, published an opinion piece for The Hill, pleading for a viable third-party candidate in the 2024 presidential election. In the 2024 election, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Cornel West are running as independents, and Jill Stein is running as a Green Party candidate. The political organization No Labels has no current candidate. Mark Shanahan, an associate professor in politics at the University of Surrey in the United Kingdom, agreed that the U.S. is pretty much baked into a two-party system, making it unlikely for a third party to arise. However bad the situation has been in the major parties historically, attempts to forge a third way, have failed, he told Newsweek. Also, one has to remember that there has always been an overlap between the parties, with the left fringe of the GOP and the right fringe of the Democrats being largely indistinguishable. Some centrist Republicans may seek a port in a storm among the Democrats, but many are hoping for the fervency of Trumpism to burn out at the 2024 election. However, it is naive to say that Main Street Republicans will waltz back into the key positions if Trump loses. Trump owes his position to a concerted shift to the right that started with the Tea Party insurgents. Many of those people are still active. If Biden is reelected, there will be a fight for the soul of the GOP, and which side wins will be down to the fundamental strength of Trumpism, denuded of its figurehead. A different GOP may emerge, but the two-party system remains extremely stubborn. Thomas Whalen also told Newsweek that forming a new party was highly unlikely. For now, they'll probably just hold their noses and hope Trump and the MAGA movement implode in the fall, he said. They'll kick and scream some, but they'll toe the party line for the most part when everything is said and done. This is from the World section of the magazine. Putin speaks out on Moscow mass shooting by Brendan Cole. Russian President Vladimir Putin alleged that Ukraine tried to help in the escape of the perpetrators of the terrorist attack on the Moscow concert center that has killed at least 133 people. The Islamic State ISIS group has claimed responsibility for Friday night's attack on Crocus City Hall, a large music venue, in which armed men entered and opened fire on concertgoers. The United States said the IS claim was credible, or ISIS. Putin said on Saturday that all the suspects had been apprehended on their way to Ukraine, where early reports indicate that a window had been prepared to cross the international border, although the Russian leader did not blame Kyiv directly. Newsweek has not yet been able to verify Putin's claim, and Ukraine has firmly denied it had anything to do with the attacks. Newsweek has contacted the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry for comment. In his comments more than 19 hours after the attack, the Russian leader said that four direct perpetrators of the terrorist attack have been arrested, and a total of 11 people have been detained. It is already obvious that we are faced with more than just a cynical planned terrorist attack, he said. All the perpetrators, organizers, and customers of this crime will be punished. Whoever they are, whoever directs them, I repeat, we will establish and punish everyone who stands behind the terrorist who prepared this atrocity, this blow for Russia, for our people. He added that terrorist murderers who do not and cannot have a nationality will face one unenviable fate, retribution, and oblivion. Putin, meanwhile, made no intention of ISIS in his address, in which he declared Sunday a national day of mourning. However, comments from Kremlin propagandists have prompted social media users to speculate that Putin was planning to blame the attacks on Ukraine. Certainly, it looks like the Kremlin will blame Kyiv, presumably paving the way for more mobilization, Kevin Rothrock from independent Russian media outlet Medusa posted on X, formerly Twitter, on Saturday. Russia's persistent attempts to implicate Ukraine in the attack began with military bloggers and propagandists and now have come full circle, security expert Maria Avdiva wrote on X, who added, typical Russian disinformation at play. Putin's comments coincided with a statement by the Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson, Maria Zakharova, who said Kyiv's regime has been carrying out active and systematic terrorist activities against Russian citizens. Unverified videos shared on social media purported to show two men who had been arrested over the attack, although neither mentioned any connection with Ukraine. This is from the news section of the magazine. Lauren Boebert insulted by students confusing her for Nancy Pelosi by Rachel Dobkin. Representative Lauren Boebert, a Colorado Republican, said during a live stream on Friday that she was insulted by a group of students confusing her for former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Boebert went on Rumble, a conservative streaming platform, on Friday, voice her dissent of the $1.2 trillion spending bill that House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Louisiana Republican, put on the floor on Friday. The bill, which funds government agencies like the U.S. Department of Defense, DOD, and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, DHS, was passed by a vote of 286 to 134 in the House. The Congresswoman who voted against the bill was criticizing part of the spending package that she said would give $5 million to a group that specializes in transgender medicine when she segued into an anecdote from Capitol Hill on Thursday. You want to be adult, an adult. You want to spend your own money to change your body up. Sure. You know I'm a fan of Botox, Bobert said. Actually, actually, side note, let's tell a little story here. I may need some more. The congresswoman continued, yesterday I was walking on the Capitol Hill complex, and this group of students got really excited, and I hear them. They go, hey, that's Nancy Pelosi. Another says, oh my gosh, yeah, that is. That's Nancy Pelosi. I started looking around. It's me. Like, oh, Lord, I need some Botox. I don't think I've ever been so insulted in my life. She then quipped, well, until we spent $1.2 trillion on groups that specialize in transgender medicine. When Newsweek reached out to Pelosi's office via email on Saturday about Boebert's comments, a spokesperson for Pelosi sarcastically asked, who? Newsweek reached out to Boebert's office via email for comment. Representative Pelosi, a California Democrat who took office in 1987, had been in a House leadership position from 2002 to 2023, took a lot of heat from Republicans during her tenure, including from Boebert. In December 2022, Boebert shared her contempt after a room in the Capitol complex was named in honor of Pelosi, saying in a video posted to social media, I can't think of anything less important or, frankly, anyone less deserving. Meanwhile, Johnson's $1.2 trillion bill passed hours before the government was set to partially shut down with the help of Democrats. In total, 101 Republicans and 185 Democrats voted in favor of the bill, while 112 Republicans and 22 Democrats voted against it. After months of delaying a government shutdown with stopgap bills, Congress managed to keep the government funded till September 30th after the Senate passed the $1.2 trillion spending package by a vote of 74 to 24 in the early morning hours of Saturday. The bill was passed after funding for federal agencies expired yesterday at midnight. However, the government did not shut down because the White House was confident that the bill would be passed by the Senate and signed by President Joe Biden on Saturday. I think we'll get into the magazine's debate now. My goodness, it's about happy anniversary Obamacare. What is its legacy 14 years later? Let's see what we got here from the opinion section. As Obamacare turns 14, it continues to bully U.S. patients. Opinion by Sally C. Pipes, President and CEO, and Thomas W. Smith, Fellow in Healthcare Policy, the Pacific Research Institute. March 23rd marks the 14th anniversary of the passage of Obamacare, also known as the Affordable Care Act, ACA. At the signing ceremony, then Vice President Joe Biden famously remarked, "This is a big effing deal." How right he was, much to the chagrin of patients who have been stuck with the monstrosity that is the Affordable Care Act ever since. For the last decade, Obamacare has driven the cost of health care coverage up and the quality of care down. It's long past time to advance market-oriented reforms that would actually yield more affordable care. Americans are paying more for health care coverage than ever before. In 2019, just 5 years after Obamacare's cost-inflating regulations took effect, average premiums had more than doubled compared to what they were pre-ACA. Premiums have continued to climb. The average family in 2023 paid 22% more for employer-sponsored coverage than they did in 2018. Deductibles have also spiraled out of control. For mid-level silver plans, deductibles have doubled since 2014, having to spend ever more out of pocket before receiving a dime from their insurers may cause people to question why they're buying Obamacare insurance in the first place. These cost increases are no accident. They were baked in from the start. Obamacare's mandates are designed to increase costs for the general population as a means of subsidizing coverage for favored groups. The law prevents insurers from setting premiums for older patients at more than three times those for younger people, despite the fact that older patients' claims costs are significantly higher than the multiple on average. So young people's premiums are higher than they would be absent Obamacare. Another mandate requires insurers to sell to all patients, no matter their health status or medical history. The effect, again, is to raise costs for everyone rather than subsidizing coverage directly for high-risk patients. The law also mandates that exchange plans cover 10 essential health benefits, including mental health services and behavioral health treatments, even if patients don't need or want them. In 2023, exchange enrollment broke records, with more than 16 million Americans signing up. Record enrollment is a function of the lavish premium subsidies that Democrats have used to blunt the impact of those skyrocketing premiums. Most enrollees have no idea how much their insurance costs because taxpayers are covering much of the TAP form. Once they sign up, they may find their exchange plans confine them to narrow provider networks. As a result, patients often have to travel long distances or wait for care, particularly in rural, less populated counties. According to a 2022 report by the Government Accountability Office, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services identified almost two-thirds of insurers they examined as not in compliance with network adequacy standards for the year ahead. So yes, Obamacare has proved itself a big effing deal for all the wrong reasons. Thankfully, there are alternatives to this legacy of failure. Congressional Republicans have proposed a number of ideas for leveraging the power of market competition to make insurance and care more affordable. One measure, the Access Act, would allow lower-income families eligible for cost-sharing reduction subsidies under Obamacare to receive those funds in a tax-advantaged health savings account. At present, that money goes directly to their insurer to reduce their out-of-pocket obligations. Under the Access Act, they'd control that money. If they want therapy that their insurer doesn't cover or would like to visit a doctor not in the health plan's network, they can use their HSA, that's health savings account funds, to pay for it. Another bill, the Healthcare Fairness for All Act, would, among other things, allow people under 65 to receive a tax credit for up to $4,000 and children a credit of up to $2,000 to put toward insurance premiums or out-of-pocket costs. Once again, patients, not insurers, decide how their healthcare dollars should be spent. Whatever they don't spend each year could be contributed to a health savings account, HSA, and carried forward into future years. Injecting more consumerism into the healthcare market in ways like these will force providers to improve quality and reduce their prices. At age 14, Obamacare has developed a habit of bullying U.S. patients. It's time they got more choices, not fewer. Here's the other side of the debate from the opinion section. Obamacare is a lifeline for immigrants like me, opinion. By Jorge Neri. This year, 21.3 million Americans chose Affordable Care Act Marketplace Coverage, that's ACA, during the open enrollment period. About a fourth of those were new to the marketplace, and 16 million Americans renewed their coverage. Despite its popularity and the fact that it's a lifeline for millions of people, former President Donald Trump is threatening to terminate it. This is exactly why I work in politics, to ensure the representation of underrepresented and marginalized voices. The fight against the dismantling of ACA, colloquially known as Obamacare, is personal, not just because I'm an immigrant from a low-income community who knows what it's like to live without insurance, but because I worked in the White House during the Obama administration, during the ACA's 2014 rollout. I've seen how important this work is to Democrats and specifically to President Joe Biden. Back then, I was secure and felt inadequate. I was surrounded by people who boasted college credentials from some of the top schools in the nation. I didn't finish college. That wasn't even the worst of it. My family faced a number of hardships just before I was set to graduate from high school. This threw me into a survival mode. I became a college dropout. My only goal was to make it through each day. This went on for 4 years. I was 19 working for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union when I had health insurance for the first time in my life. Fighting for basic human rights is what put me on the path to the White House. It was in my role as Associate Director of Latino and Immigration Affairs where I was asked to devise a plan to help Latinos understand the importance of the program and to get them to sign up for it. I struggled with the basic memo writing in relation to my peers. The task of creating a successful rollout plan felt like a Herculean task. That's Herculean task. That is where I see the importance of diversity in age, generation, socioeconomic status. It was my boss, Latina Julie Chavez Rodriguez, who saw me for who I was. She encouraged me to step into my power and allow my lived experience to be as authoritative as a college degree. I was the only individual in the room who grew up without health insurance. I was also the only person with a family still uninsured. I know firsthand what it's like to treat a pharmacist like a makeshift doctor, to pay in cash for doctor visits, or to avoid primary care because past bills are due. I leaned in and helped write the plans still being used today to help people obtain health insurance. The memo took me hours, but it was worth it. I want people to know that it was a Mexican immigrant whose first language is Spanish, who grew up uninsured, who fought to make sure their voices were heard so they wouldn't have to live their life being uninsured. This is exactly what I told the then Vice President Joe Biden when I was assigned to brief him for a Latino town hall on ACA 10 years ago. He responded in the affirmative with a snap of his fingers, and I got it. He could see Obamacare's value and importance to helping people live healthy lives. In President Biden's first term, he took on insurance companies to lower the price of insulin and prescription drugs and fought to save Medicare, Medicaid, and the ACA, which did not surprise me. That moment in my life working on the ACA was pivotal. It also has a special significance in relation to the status quo. My boss, who kept me going when I felt like I wasn't smart enough to be doing this work, was Julie Chavez Rodriguez, now the campaign manager for President Joe Biden's 2024 reelection campaign. Representation matters, and so do diverse life experiences. Latinos have been a priority for Democrats since day one and continue to be so at a time when people like Trump work to dismantle systems that help marginalized communities. Last year, my mom became a breast cancer survivor. Her hospital bills were well over six figures. Without Medicare, her healthy victory would have been overshadowed with the news of financial ruin. I no longer work in the White House, but the threats against ACA continue. I'll stay in the fight for as long as needed. Access to health care transformed my life and the lives of countless others. For my mother, the ACA wasn't just a policy. It was a beacon of hope, the first step toward a healthier, more secure future. Joe Biden's unwavering commitment to safeguarding the ACA is paramount. As president, he champions healthcare as a fundamental right, prioritizing its protection and expansion. His dedication resonates with individuals like me who understand firsthand the transformative impact of accessible healthcare. The ACA isn't just legislation, it's a lifeline for millions. Its preservation ensures that no one endures the hardship of being uninsured. Jorge Neri was an appointee in the Barack administration and served on President Joe Biden's campaign and transition team. This comes under the heading of fact check. Michelle Obama's President 2024 viral video is bogus by Tom Norton. President Joe Biden's 2024 presidential election campaign has been surrounded by speculation that other high-profile candidates, such as California Governor Gavin Newsom and former First Lady Michelle Obama, can enter the fray. While Biden is the presumptive Democratic nominee, concerns about his age and competency have led to speculation that others might take on the mantle despite their denials. A recent viral TikTok viewed more than 7 million times claimed that this time had come, stating that Michelle Obama had formally announced a 2024 run. A TikTok video posted on February 10th, 2024, by user Political Prowess, viewed 7.2 million times, included the headline, Michelle Obama announces she's running for president in 2024. Comment your reaction. The video included a clip of Michelle Obama in which she said that a woman can be president of the United States. I want a president with a record of public service. Someone whose life work shows our children that we don't chase fame and fortune for ourselves. We fight to give everyone a chance to succeed, and we give back even when we're struggling ourselves because we know that there is always someone worse off, and there but for the grace of God go I. Michelle Obama has not announced a run for the White House. Spokesperson Crystal Carson told NBC News last week that the former First Lady will not run. As former First Lady Michelle Obama has expressed several times over the years, she will not be running for president, Carson said. Mrs. Obama supports President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris's re-election campaign. The video attached to the TikTok is nearly 8 years old, taken from a July 2016 speech at the Democratic National Convention in support of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. The TikTok starts with a truncated sentence from that speech in which Michelle Obama said, "And because of Hillary Clinton, my daughters and all of our sons and daughters now take for granted that a woman can be president of the United States." The user who posted the clip has published multiple videos falsely stating that Michelle Obama is running for office. The account has also published content asking viewers whether the former First Lady should run for office. Perhaps tellingly, the user's TikTok account information includes a link to a merchandise page with paraphernalia for the made-up campaign. Newsweek has contacted the office of Barack and Michelle Obama for comment. My name is Dean Horton. I read to you some current articles from Newsweek magazine.